Hey, folks, Pattern is a disability insurance company, and they know that you want to be confident and in control of your finances. In order to do that, you need to buy disability insurance. Pattern understands the problem is that researching insurance is complicated and time-consuming, which can make you feel overwhelmed and unsure of who to trust. Pattern knows that your time is valuable, and they believe that doctors have more important things to do than worry about insurance. That's why thousands of doctors have trusted Pattern to help them understand the insurance they're buying. Here's how they do it. You go in, you request your quotes, you compare your options, and you buy risk-free. So request your quotes today at patternlife.com. That's PATTERNLIFE.com. So you can stop wasting time and feeling overwhelmed and instead save money and spend time on the things you love, being confident your family and income are protected. Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw and I'm coming to you with a very special episode on COVID-19. I was lucky enough to get in touch with Mike Scott from Penn, who's one of the chiefs of critical care there. And he is has been working closely with Mauricio Serreta, who is one of the critical care docs there and has been in close touch with a really wonderful physician, anesthesiologist in Italy, who's really on the front lines. And so we put this together very last minute. This all came together just in the past day. So you'll see it's going to be a little bit helter-skelter, but really, I think, important messages coming across from some of what they've been thinking about at Penn and some of what has been happening in Italy on the ground and what really they are describing as a war zone. You'll hear some tough things about what's having to happen in Italy. It will not be easy to listen to. I want to have the huge, huge flag and caveat up front to say, of course, that things are changing on a daily basis here. What we discuss in terms of what may or may not be good things to do may change by tomorrow. And so I want to urge people to check with your local hospital, infection control folks, figure out what the protocols that are being put in place at your hospital are and follow those. Please don't assume that what we're saying is advice to be taken directly into patient care. This is stuff to think about and discuss with your colleagues, with your hospital, with your leadership. And for everybody out there, if there are lay folks listening to this, this is really about prevention. And you'll hear us emphasize that again and again. What can we all do, all of us as citizens, to try to prevent us getting to the point that they have reached in Italy, where they're having to decide who gets a ventilator and who just has to die because they don't have enough ventilators, they don't have enough hospital beds, they don't have enough ICU beds for the enormous number of cases, let alone other people who are just sick and don't have COVID. So we don't want to get there. And in order to prevent it, we need to be responsible ourselves. So let that be the biggest take-home message. You'll hear us talk about that. And you'll hear us talk about a lot of the other lessons that can be learned from their experience there in Italy. All right, so let's jump in. My apologies, the audio is not going to be great. I was supposed to be away on vacation. We've canceled that trip, but I don't have any of my normal recording equipment with me here at home. It's at work where I had left it. So the audio won't be probably what we're normally used to here. But we'll do the best we can. I think just for the sake of the seriousness of the issue, we're not going to do kind of random recommendations for now with this group. I will say that most likely the live ACRAC episode will be canceled. We'll kind of definitively announce that within the next few weeks, but I think we're most likely to have to put that off until this is all settled down and it's safe to have a large group again together. So please, if you were planning on coming in April, thank you for those plans, but let's assume for now that that won't be happening, and let's get on with learning what we can from some of the folks on the front lines here. I have with me three incredible experts who have agreed to spend some time discussing what's going on with COVID right now. I've got Dr. Mike Scott, who listeners will remember was on the show a while back talking about a completely different topic, but he's now one of the division chiefs of critical care at Penn and has been very involved in preparations there. I've also got with me Dr. Mauricio Serreta, who is also an anesthesia critical care doc
He is also the head of the ICU fellowship at Penn and does a lot of research on ARDS. And then really special, and I'm so grateful to have with us one of his colleagues who was actually one of his medical students in Italy.
And is now an anesthesiologist and critical care doc there.
Dr. Mirko Nicotti, who is on the ground in Italy and has agreed to spend some time, despite, I'm sure, being exhausted, sharing with us some of what is going on there and what they've learned. He is also an anesthesiologist and a cardiac anesthesiologist there in Bergamo, which is about an hour and a half from Milan, and is really on the ground with some of the worst cases that we have going on. And they've learned a lot and are here to share with us. So I want to start with you, Mike, and ask you to just, you know, let's do some very basic. Let's review, what are we talking about? When people say the coronavirus or COVID, or, you know, some people may know the actual virus's name, SARS-CoV-2, just take me through what we're dealing with here.
Yeah, so it's been described as a novel coronavirus. Coronaviruses are recognized because they've got this, like, crown when you look at them on an electron microscopy.
Right.
It was called COVID-19 purely because it's been classified in 2019. And now, because it's been associated with severe acute respiratory syndrome, it's basically been renamed SARS-CoV-2 or SARS-CoV-2. So it's the same type of virus that was the SARS epidemic in 2002-04 and also the MERS epidemic in 2012. It was first described, obviously, back in Wuhan. I think everyone realizes it. It really initially came from there, and then it's been spreading now. And it's now, I think, in 140 countries, and there's been over 160,000 cases, which are just the reported diagnosed cases. I mean, the amount of cases out there will be many times more than this. And there's been particularly affected areas like South Korea, Iran, and Italy. And I think the events in Italy have really focused everyone's minds because of the fact that they've got a very advanced healthcare system like we have here. And yet they have suffered from a real overwhelming number of patients needing high-level critical care because they were presenting with this acute respiratory distress syndrome and needing intensive care to basically ventilate them for a period of time of normally about 7-ish days. And the remarkable thing about this infection is it doesn't really, it's not like it doesn't present in the normal way of a common cold necessarily, that there seems to be this long period where you might not show an infection. In fact, many people might not show an infection. So it means that it's spread very, very rapidly and there's exponential spread. And that's one of the key things, is containment seems to be very, very difficult and very challenging for countries.
Right. So, you know, some of the terms people may hear are this quarantine period, right? So we think that if you are if you're at high risk, if you've been exposed, you need to be out of contact with people for long enough so that you can know for sure if you have it. This is assuming you can't be tested, right? So this is why we're asking people to isolate, to have some social isolation, and especially if they have any symptoms, to self-quarantine.
Yes, that's right. And one of the challenges we've had in the USA is we haven't had the testing kits. A lot of other countries have developed rapid testing kits, which is happening here as well. For instance, in South Korea, they have even drive-by testing stations where they've been testing up to 10,000 patients a day, where patients drive by in their car, stop, and within 10 minutes, there's a PCR test, which they can then get a positive or negative result. And that's been very useful in trying to map the movement of the infection and contain it.
And why do we not have that here? Do we not have the technology or the reagents or the machines? What is stopping us from being able to do that?
Well, we do now have the tests. I think it's a question of getting them available and in sufficient quantities. That's above my pay grade, obviously, to answer those questions. But my belief is that there's a large number of testing kits going to be made available in the next week or so.
Okay, great. So we're hoping to have that. So everybody, you mentioned, and I think people understand, that this is thought of as affecting the lungs. People can develop anything from a mild respiratory symptom to severe ARDS and need to be on a ventilator. It also, though, has some GI effects and maybe even some myocardial effects. Is that right?
Yeah, that some patients get a bit of diarrhea. I think that there's a mild and severe form. The severe form is a fever and a cough and shortness of breath. And then with other things, you can get chest pain. There's now increasing recognition there's a myocarditis, so inflammation of the heart. And in some patients over in Seattle, my understanding is they've suffered cardiac arrest because of myocarditis. There's also another group of patients that develop acute kidney injury. It's currently unclear whether that's the direct virus involvement or the fact that our critical care strategy is to limit fluid on these patients because they otherwise get very leaky lungs. And so therefore the kidney function is basically being challenged because we're running these patients dry.
Right. Okay. So, and then who's getting this? So I think people have heard that unlike some other illnesses, the very young seem to be doing relatively well, where the old folks older than 70 tend to have more severe disease. And then there's some talk that healthcare workers, even controlling for kind of how healthy they may be, tend to have more severe disease. And that's a little unclear why. What is that kind of what we know?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an epidemiologist, obviously, but there is certainly the elderly patients and those who have comorbidities such as heart, lung, kidney, smokers have a higher incidence of problems and mortality. But it isn't completely confined to the elderly. There is an incidence in the below 50s, although it's low. But Mirko, I think, will be able to tell us more about the distribution of disease from Italy when he comes on.
Yeah, absolutely. We know you mentioned the kind of countries that have been hit the hardest so far. In the United States, we've seen on the West Coast, so Seattle is seeing a huge number of infections. And then obviously Washington State in general, there's some outside Seattle. There's kind of movement from the West Coast. Do we think that that's kind of moving across now? Obviously, New York having increasing numbers. It's really kind of everywhere. What do we think? Are we thinking that this is going to have an exponential spread? Is there any way to know that?
Well, all we can do really is follow what's happened in other countries and the fact that the spread does seem to be exponential. We obviously know it's droplet-borne, but there is some evidence coming out. You might have live virus in the feces. There's two publications recently, one in JAMA. So that might be why the virus is spreading so quickly. But obviously, you're much more likely to get the virus if you're coming into contact with someone and in enclosed spaces. So just like the flu virus or any other type of these infections. So I think we're still mapping the epidemiology, and also we don't know if people get reinfected or not. But I think the key thing is we know that containment is really the only way to reduce the endpoint, because we, from experience around the other countries, is if you can, even a few days of containment get you a reduced number that get infected. There's some calculations suggesting that every 4 days means you double the number of people who go to intensive care. So the sooner you get containment, the better.
Yeah, that's a huge number, obviously, depending on what you start with, and could easily overwhelm. And I think we'll hear from Mirko kind of what they're facing there. I want to ask you what you mentioned that this is traveling obviously through droplets, maybe through fecal passing as well. It lives on surfaces, I think, for a little while from what we know. There was just a very recent paper in the New England Journal looking at different types of surfaces, cardboard, plastic, metal. And finding that, at minimum, we're talking about many hours, up to a day or two, where the virus can stay alive on these surfaces. So that's a huge problem for infection as well. You can imagine walking through an area, even if nobody sneezes or coughs or even touches you, you put your hand on a railing or a doorknob that someone recently touched with virus, you can get it that way. Is that what your understanding is?
Yeah, it is. And that's why the basic levels of hygiene are important. So to wash your hands for 20 seconds, which will kill the virus, not touch your mouth, eyes or nose, because that's the way you can self-infect. Obviously, be away from people who are infected with who cough, sneezing, but obviously you can't always do that. And if you have got a sneeze or something is to sneeze, if you haven't got a handkerchief to sneeze into and bin it, then you would sneeze into your upper arm rather than your hands and then pass it on. So these are basic things, but very important to contain the spread of the virus.
Yeah, absolutely. So what do we know in terms of prevention? Right now, social isolation, and maybe we should just define that term. What is optimal social isolation right now? What if we could tell people exactly what to do, what would it mean?
Again, I'm not speaking as an epidemiologist. I'm speaking as a critical care physician. So I wouldn't really know the official definition of that. But what we do know that's happened locally in Philadelphia, and very sensibly, the schools have been closed. They've stopped people from going to large gatherings. In our workplace at Penn alone, we're not allowed to have groups of 20 people, and in fact even less than that now, and we try and do all of our meetings by some sort of Skype or over the phone. We are even encouraging people to work from home. So we're just trying to stop unnecessary contact journeys and meeting of people.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you know, we've got similar kind of stuff happening here in Maryland, schools being closed, et cetera. You know, I think the way we've interpreted is just limit contact as much as possible. You know, we're supposed to be away on spring break. We canceled that. We're staying home. We're not going out to restaurants. We're not, you know, having the grandparents come over, et cetera. We are really just trying to isolate as much as possible, obviously, with the exception of needing to go to work. And I think we'll talk a little later about healthcare workers specifically and what healthcare workers can do both at work and at home. I guess let me ask you, as someone who's obviously, you know, working in the ICUs at Penn, and Mauricio can comment on this too, but when you're thinking about coming home after a day taking care of potentially infected patients, are you doing anything before you come home? Are you doing anything differently to try to protect your family?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't had direct exposure with someone with COVID-19 yet because we're in the early days, but I still behave as if I had. So I basically frequent hand washing with soap and using the hand sanitizers on the wall at every opportunity. I think you can't do enough of that.
Yeah. Is there any, do you think, what, you know, are people thinking about the concern of if you're, I mean, presumably you're changing out of scrubs, obviously, and then going home in different clothing than you wore to work, though on your way from the locker room through the rest of the hospital, you could obviously bump into things, touch railings, et cetera. Washing hands will take care of things you touch with your hands. I'm wondering if people are thinking, you know, now my clothes may get contaminated before I get home. Is that something that's being addressed at all, or we're just kind of sticking with the hands?
Yeah, we haven't done anything with our clothes yet.
I do.
What do you do, Mauricio?
Essentially, I've changed my life routine significantly. Besides washing hands, etc., I change immediately as soon as I come home. Definitely, I don't go back and forth with scrubs. I don't let my kids to touch me until I have changed. I'm very, very careful about touching face and washing my hands and. I actually even thinking about changing shoes, coming back from the hospital. So it's I think you have to be paranoid. We have to live like that, no matter what we feel about it, and that's what we have to do. My concern is that I look around in the community, and I don't think nobody cares. To give you an idea, they cancel the St. Patrick's Day parade. If you remember the Philadelphia, the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic, Philadelphia was doomed because they did not give up a parade, and the mortality after the parade was immense. So, believe it or not, the St. Patrick's parade was canceled only 2 days ago. Yet, I saw a bunch of kids, college kids, going around bar hopping, big groups of kids. So they did their own parade anyway. So we'll see what's going to happen in the next 2 weeks after that. The attention wasn't that high a week ago, but only a week ago we had the flower show. The famous Philadelphia flower show brings in, is the equivalent of a massive medical convention. So brings in lots of people from all over the country. And that happened a week ago. The city was so crowded with people. So that's we can be careful in our own little community. I stopped going to see my mother. She's 81. I don't want to bring anything to her.
Right.
But and she cannot see her grandchildren, sadly. But it is what it is.
That's right. So I want to, Mike, I know you may have to pop out of the call at some point. So I want to let you, if there's anything else you didn't get a chance to comment on that you wanted to, I want to give you that chance and then turn to Mirko and really hear what they've been dealing with there in Italy and what lessons they can share with us. But Mike, anything you want to comment on?
Well, I think we've got to plan this approach twofold. One is the social isolation and a statewide policy. I think there's clear indications we need to cohort patients so that we don't contaminate our other health services. And so having a strategy within your hospital healthcare system is key. And I think Mirko will, that's the thing he's proposing. So I think what's key is that we listen to him and implement the appropriate strategies wherever you are providing healthcare.
Thank you, Mike. Please feel free to chime in as long as you're still on the call. So Mirko, thank you again so much for taking some time. You must be exhausted, and thank you for all the work you're doing there. Let me ask you if you could take us through, you know, both what you're dealing with there and what, after having been through, you know, what you've been through, what have you learned? What would you want us to take away?
So today we have 552 cases confirmed at the WHO in Bergamo. And in Milan, we have 200. The distance from Milan and Bergamo is 50 kilometers. So the first question is, why this difference? Why we have 3,400 cases from the beginning in Bergamo and 1,700 cases in Milan? First of all is try to understand your epidemiology. Milan and Bergamo are very near. So if you have so huge difference, there is a reason. It's not the virus that is crazy. It's the man that is crazy. So something in the society is wrong. We do not understand what happens. Nobody. The situation is totally under control because nobody has a good epidemiological data. And if you read the literature in this period, most of the papers speak about ICU treatment. This is not a problem. When you see a paper that speak about ICU situation and problem, put in the garbage. Because if you try to treat your COVID virus with the ICU mentality, you fail. If you read the Singapore experience, you can understand that on December 31, 2019, China informed the World Health Organization of a novel viral pneumonia. Do you know when the Singapore people start to check the people in the country? 4 days later. 4 days later. And Singapore catch the first case of coronavirus the 3rd of January, 20 days after the discovery of the virus. The truth that Singapore received a lot Chinese population, about 300,000 visitors per month. Do you know how many visitors arrive in your country? I do not, in Italy. Yeah. But this is an important question. Singapore experience, Taiwan experience, China experience teach us a lot. But we are not epidemiological mentality. If you read the Singapore paper, you can read, you don't find ICU word. You find the word public health. So after when Singapore understand the situation of China, promptly shift its public health response level to enhanced preparedness. That means that activate all the public health facility to catch the virus. And Singapore, if you read the report of the case in Singapore, you don't find many cases. And Singapore is very near to the China. This is main...
Mirko, let me just clarify. So you're saying, if I'm understanding you, that, you know, if you wait until you've got your ICUs full and then you start thinking about this as an ICU issue, you're way too late. You have to think of it as a public health issue. You have to do what Singapore did, which is be very, very proactive. And they were able to control this because they didn't wait around until they were dealing with an ICU crisis. Is that right?
Yeah. What do you think when the virus arrived in USA, in your opinion?
I don't know. I mean, I think probably a lot earlier than we think.
When?
I don't know. Maurizio, do you know?
No, well, I'm reading on social media from postings from people in Seattle. They think they had ARDS cases in their ICUs already at the beginning of February. Some of them died. So they want to go back and check. I think it's been there longer. I'm sure Milton will tell us this. Probably it's going to be even earlier than that. But I suspect we are surrounded by COVID patients already as we speak, and we have been for a while. Yeah, but Mirko is probably going to tell us more about this.
Yeah, Mirko, so you tell us, when was the first year?
So in my opinion, the first case recognized in China because one doctor opened the mind and recognized a strange pneumonia. This was the first case, 8 December. How many cases are recognized by doctors without open minds happens before?
Yeah, exactly.
And the latency period may be 15 days. So maybe the virus is starting to spread in November. How many travelers from China to USA from November to December?
Yeah.
So in this period, I work in two places, in the Central Hospital of Bergamo, 900 beds, and because of this situation, I work also in a Lidl hospital healthcare around Bergamo. In this hospital, during the crazy night of this period, I speak a lot with the nurse. And every time I try to ask to the nurse, because there is no a lot doctor over there, do you remember strange case of pneumonia in this space? And two, three nurses told me, I remember in December, at the beginning of December, several cases of pneumonia in Yang arrived in this hospital three times. First time with antibiotic, second time with antibiotic, and third time, after 3 weeks, the pneumonia was still here. Maybe it was coronavirus?
Right.
So the virus is with you, I think, a long time ago.
Right. So, yeah, so and I think you're probably...
I think you are late.
Yes, I think you're probably right. So you now have, you know, and by you, I mean in Italy, in some areas, right? I mean, there's an overwhelming number of cases there, a lot of critically ill patients. Tell us a little about what you're seeing and what you've learned from, you know, so clearly, as you just said, one huge lesson is we don't want to wait. We need to be proactive. And we talked with Mike about some of the things we can do. And I think Maurizio will give us some more on that in a little bit. But tell me a little more about, you know, what you're actually seeing on the ground and what lessons you've learned both for the general public and for healthcare providers.
Yeah. Today, in the main journal of our city, Lecco di Bergamo, you can find 10 pages of person die. 10 pages. All the journal is composed about these pages with person that die. This is the situation. We have no space for patient that die because all the Maurizio cimitero. How do you say cimitero in English?
Graveyard or cemetery.
Okay. All cemetery are full.
Yeah. It's like a war. I mean, this is what you people write about during wartime.
Yes, this is a real catastrophic situation. It's an humanitarian crisis. And the situation is totally no control. So for this reason, the mortality is so high because the number of patients in the hospital are too much. And we are not able to face front to everything. The hospital of Lombardia is one of the most rich region of the north of Italy. The internal product is the same of the Germany. So the quality of life is the same of the USA. The hospital is the same of the USA. But we were not proactive. We did not believe to the Chinese population. We did not how many travelers arrive from China every day. You know, the airport of Bergamo is the second airport of the Italy for passengers. So a lot of epidemic situation Maurizio, this is the story that Maurizio in these days heard a lot, but epidemic situation is first of all a social problem. So you have to understand the social, the key social point that promotes the diffusion of the virus. Because if you don't understand that, you can increase ICU bed every day, but you can stop the contamination. And now we are in quarantine, but we are not China. There is no dictature here. So I'm not sure that we can maintain quarantine 2 months, 3 months. School in China are still closed. And the peak of the contamination was 1-2 months ago. Wuhan Hospital did not receive any case in this moment. Any case. And our city is destroyed. What do you mean destroyed? I work for 3 years in the major crisis with the Doctors Without Borders. It's the same situation. It's the same situation. So yes, we are more rich, but what that I'm explaining to my chief, but they don't understand, is if every city around you has the same situation, this is very catastrophic, because how can the economic situation restart? It's impossible. If the problem stay in Lombardy region, my region, is the most populated region of the Italy. Italy has 60 million of inhabitants, and Lombardy has 10 million of inhabitants. This density is one of the reasons of the contamination. Because So this is one of the reasons. The second reason, I think, but I have no data. Why? Because in Bergamo, there is no a surveillance system. So nobody searched the reason for this incredible contamination. This is incredible, but we don't know why. I have an idea, because I observe the people that work. People for the first 2-3 weeks work in contaminated fashion. No protection.
Yep.
No formation. 2 weeks in an epidemic situation is a dramatic period. You know, every day here seems 1 year before. The situation is totally different.
Mirko, what do you mean by that? Every day is like 1 year before.
Because yesterday we have 3,000 cases, and today 400 cases. Last week we have 200 people with COVID in our hospital, and now we have 500 people in our hospital. 500 people with COVID in a hospital with 900 beds. What do you mean? And 500 people in critical situation. Normally these people have to stay in intensive care, but we have no space.
Right.
For this reason, the mortality is high.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And how are you deciding, you know, when you have multiple patients who need a ventilator and not enough ventilators, or multiple patients who need to be in the ICU and not enough ICU beds? What are you doing to address that?
The stronger people survive, the other die.
Yeah.
That's not medicine, this.
Yeah.
Is an automatic triage.
So you're saying the ones who survive long enough are going to get the intensive care? The ones who survive until there's a bed or a ventilator.
So we have we increase a lot bed of intensive care. Now we have 80 bed of intensive care in our hospital. Every bed is COVID. So if a people with traumatic injury arrive in the hospital, there is no bed. There is no free bed for him.
Right.
Do you understand the situation?
I don't think I could. I mean, I hear you, and I'm just in. You know, it's hard to, I think, process. Sounds just like we said, a war zone, or, you know, just a complete overwhelming of the infrastructure. But it sounds like what you're saying is that, you know, obviously every single critical care bed you have is taken up with COVID patients. The next, you know, every other patient who comes in, there's no bed. So they either survive because they're strong, or they, you know, and they get over it, or they die and they become one of those 10 pages of names.
We can intubate patient over 70 year. We can intubate.
You cannot.
No.
So the policy is if you're over 70, you don't get a breathing tube.
Can I speak freely, Maurizio?
I think so.
My chief established an evidence-based score. Your evidence-based score, and invite people to do this. But there is no, it's not writing.
And you're saying the score would determine whether you get a ventilator or not?
The score is if you have only one organ failure, lung, I intubate you. If you have two organ failure, there is no possibility.
Yeah, this is like wartime triage. Yeah.
Right, because this is the problem. I have 70 patients in the ICU, and I have 40 patients that wait to enter in ICU. But the period of the respiratory failure may be 2 weeks.
Right, absolutely.
So, and another thing, the 500 people that stay out of the ICU are critical patients. With non-invasive ventilation, with helmet CPAP, but there is no specialized people to treat them, because in this area there is nurse from oculistic area, from surgery, from everywhere. So right. You can create competence in one day.
Right. No, I mean, you obviously you have to use whatever resources you have. Let me ask you about the mortality rate that you're seeing. We've been hearing, you know, that overall we're looking at something as low as 0.5% up to maybe 3%, but in vulnerable.
In this situation, our mortality is not a good number, because we have not the possibility to treat the patient as usual.
Right. So it's going to be artificially inflated.
So it's a stupid number.
Right.
It's very high, but it is not the mortality
of the disease
that usually this patient have in normal condition.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. So this is what the mortality you're seeing is not due to the disease. It's due to the lack of ability to treat the disease.
Yes. Yeah. But the lethality of this virus is very low. When you read that is 2-3%, is too high. It's too high. The problem of this virus is that it's very contagious, 10 times that the SARS.
Right.
So SARS did 300 confirmed case in six months, and in China, And in 1 month, the COVID gave 70,000 confirmed cases, 10 times more. So the problem is that the capacity to spread in the population. And the problem is that this high capacity to spread destroy your health system. But right. Not for a day, for the next month, because we don't know when we can take care of the other patient.
Right. Right. No, I think that's the...
There is no other patient than COVID in the hospital. Where is the other now? We don't know. We don't know.
Right. The whole hospital is full of the COVID patients. So that is clearly true that in the numbers and what that you're dealing with are going to be inflated. You know, there have been some estimates that in the vulnerable population, patients older than 70, nursing home patients, for example, here, the mortality may be higher, right, in that population, maybe as high as 10 to 20%. I think that was based at least in part on the nursing home in Seattle, where out of 100 nursing home residents, you know, I think about 14 died, which would be a 14% mortality rate there. But overall, because the younger patients do better, we think that, you know, as you said, it's overall a much lower mortality rate, but the infectivity is quite high.
No, it's not the mortality, it's the lethality, it's the different. It's two different concepts. Because this is another problem on the paper that you read. Lethality is the concept that is the total number of the dead on the total number of the infected patient. What do you, if you read intensive care paper, you can read mortality about the patient recovered in your hospital. But the base, the denominator of the infected patient is more higher because most people did not arrive in the hospital, have a pouch symptomatic infection as asymptomatic but with virus. This is your denominator.
Right, but we don't know
what
that number is.
That. Yeah. Because this is the cause of it. If you know this, you can understand the travel of your virus. If you don't know this, it's impossible to understand what happens.
Right. And if I'm understanding you correctly, what you're saying is that there are a lot more cases than we know about because there's a lot of people out there who have either already had it and never knew it or who have it now and are asymptomatic. And that, if we knew that number, that would be a much bigger denominator. And so that makes sense.
The two main epidemiological key issue that you have to remember is children are asymptomatic. Only 1% of children have severe case. And so school probably is a situation where the virus diffuses very, very much. And the second condition is that the Chinese population, when did some survey on the asymptomatic patient, found the same viral load of virus in asymptomatic patient than in symptomatic patient.
Right. So
this is an important epidemiological issue.
Right. And that gets to what you were saying about the prevention is that if we have people with high viral loads walking around asymptomatic, then waiting until we have our hospitals full and trying to deal with it there is way too late. We have to do the public health, the social isolation that we were discussing before. Yeah. That's clear. I mean, I think there's no question that it sounds like such a, and for good reason, an important thing that you want to get across is not to wait to do the necessary public health interventions now and to try to prevent the results that you've seen there. What else? Let's turn to the things that you have learned in terms of caring for these patients in the hospital. What are you doing to try to provide the best care you can? I mean, one thing is obviously trying to figure out who gets limited resources, but then for the patients who are being taken care of, who are in the hospital or who are on ventilators, what are you doing for them?
So I see several patients with COVID in a hospital, and I see different patients in at home, and I see different patients in emergency room. So in my opinion, most patients with mild, moderate coronavirus pneumonia may stay at home. If you can catch early the level of saturation, probably you can bring at home oxygen. You can help us to feed, give them some nutritional composition, and if you can do this, you put in place a great system to control your epidemic situation, because you close your virus in a home. But this is an important changement of the health system, because right. And it's very difficult to prepare this. But you need only two things, saturimeter and oxygen.
Right. So you're saying that people who have a mild or even moderate case.
Mild for sure. Moderate, I don't know. But mild can stay at home, totally. And mild case is a great part of the case. You have to avoid that they arrive in a hospital, because probably they have 90 of saturation. And if you give them 2 liters of oxygen, probably is enough.
Right. And so you're actually having people who would normally be in a hospital with pneumonia receiving oxygen are getting that at home now, because there is no hospital bed for them.
So at the beginning, every people arrive in a hospital, and this was the problem, arrive with ambulance, and there was driver and volunteers without protection for at least 2-3 weeks, and this was one of the most important vector of the epidemic situation. And the people in the first day, the people arrived in the hospital and was put not in isolated area, stay in emergency room waiting for the results of the confirmation. In this period, the results of the confirmation with PCR take about 2 days to arrive.
Right.
So in these 2 days, the virus arrives everywhere.
Right, right. So if they had never come to the hospital, it would have been much better.
Yeah.
So Mauricio, is this being discussed at all in this country, the idea of potentially patients who normally would come to a hospital, keeping them at home, even on home O2?
As far as I'm aware, I don't think so. I haven't heard about it.
Okay.
I honestly do not think so.
Yeah, I haven't heard it either. Now, obviously, cohort patients.
I saw several patients at home. And what I learned that when the patient has fever, probably the lung compromission started, and probably the hypoxia starts slowly every day, day by day, because most patients, also old patients, arrive in a hospital with 70 of saturation, and they speak well, they are not very, they are a good mental state. This is not normal, because this is the situation that I see in my PICU with the congenital patient. My congenital patient has 70 of saturation, and you ask, incredible. They live with 70 of saturation. And this is the same situation that I found in most people. So I think if you can catch the oxygen or the saturation at the beginning, you can treat them with oxygen and avoid the deterioration of the organism, because this patient go in mountain for 15 days and nobody give nutrition. So it's normal that you crash. I don't know if you, if I explain the situation. Maurizio.
You do very well, Mirko.
Yeah, I mean, so I think that makes sense, you know, is that clearly we know people can, with isolated hypoxia, can do just fine. I mean, people who climb Mount Everest without oxygen obviously are up there with very low saturations. And so you absolutely, it sounds like what you're seeing is people who slowly develop this hypoxemia, and because it developed slowly, they had time to, you know, acclimatize to it, so to speak. They are coming in with, you know, low saturations, but doing otherwise fine. And you're saying this could be treated, especially if it was caught early, potentially at home, and prevent them coming into the hospital at all.
Yeah.
So we talked about cohorting patients in the hospital. Mike mentioned this earlier. So, you know, that's something I know, Maurizio, you guys are working on, we've done. Is to have, you know, these are not patients you want to have one in one unit in the negative pressure room and another in another unit, you know, just the potential for cross-contamination. You want to have a dedicated area of the hospital where these patients are kept. Now, obviously, Mirko, for you guys, you know, your whole hospital is taken up. So that's, you know, we're kind of past that point. But maybe that's one way that we, as we start to see more cases, can hopefully prevent the kind of spread both to healthcare workers and to other patients. That you guys have seen in Italy. Maurizio, is that, you think you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with you completely. But we should be very proactive. I'm not entirely sure how much institutions around the country are thinking in those terms. My concern is that in the United States, the way the healthcare system works, there is no central coordination. I'm not only talking about the federal level, but also at the statewide or even citywide. We have major big cities with major academic centers that probably don't really have a line of communication, so it's really hard to understand. I don't have a clear understanding what the role of the city, but that may be my ignorance. Because I think the ideal situation, you should protect some hospitals from COVID patients and deal with this disease in certain hospitals that have the capability and the skills to take care of them, and preserve other hospitals for other functions, the regular functions, and try to continue to maintain a minimal decent level of routine care, trauma, labor and delivery, emergency surgeries. People are continue to get sick, they get strokes, they get MIs. My biggest fear, if I understand the U.S. medical system, my biggest fear is that these patients are going to start flooding all hospitals, including peripheral hospitals, where they don't have really a preparedness plan.
Right.
And you know exactly what I'm talking about. And they will be overwhelmed. They will not manage as well. The hospitals will be contaminated. Personnel and patients will get infected. And then once they get overwhelmed, they will start flooding patients to the city hospitals. And instead, these peripheral hospitals should be protected. Not only, and I think that's a recipe for disaster. Or you can have also the other mechanism where they're gonna see the patients, try to take care of them at the beginning, get scared because this patient can tend to be extremely hypoxic, and they're gonna start immediately thinking about, oh my God, we need ECMO. call for a referral, send her to the city hospital. And still, in the process, they have contaminated their hospital, the ambulance, the old helicopter, and the accepting hospital. So I'm hope I'm wrong. I suspect that we are not there yet in terms of coordinating, and this type of thinking is not being implemented. They were not there, essentially.
Right, right. Mirko, are you guys doing any ECMO for these patients or no?
There is no good question. There is no space for ECMO.
Yeah, exactly.
If we put ECMO in one patient, maybe 10 patients die because right. So there is no space for ECMO in this situation.
Right.
When I asked the same question to one of my friends, he started laughing and said, "Who cares about ECMO? You need ventilators, you need nurses, you need beds, you need medications, antibiotics, pumps. You need all of that." And he couldn't stop laughing, thinking about ECMO. They've done some ECMOs in Milan, a couple of them. Some of them have a legitimate indication, for example, a couple of VA ECMOs for myocarditis and severe heart failure. But that's really a drop in the ocean, honestly. This is not what we're talking about. Talking to other colleagues around the country, I still think that the mind frame that's being used is a classic mind frame for severe influenza epidemic. Yep. They're thinking, this is another H1N1. We're going to be taking care of it. We're going to be doing advanced care, and we're going to get out of it. Instead, the way they should be thinking about this is disaster management, disaster planning. This is an act of is the equivalent of an act of massive terrorism that happens every day. Every day a bomb explodes in your city, and every day the bomb gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Be prepared for that. Don't worry about how much advanced stuff are you going to be able to do, because we're going to go back to 30 years ago. The good news is that this is, you know, in people who don't have many comorbidities, this seems to be a relatively easy disease to treat in a way. So we don't really do anything too fancy. We need good respiratory care and basic critical care. And we should be able to pull at least the patient who have a chance to pull them out.
Right. But what about healthcare workers? Mirko, how much are you seeing the providers who are caring for these patients contracting COVID?
There is no surveillance system for the personnel.
So we don't know?
No. Because all the PCR RNA are made on the patient.
Right. So you're not testing the healthcare workers.
But this is a stupid choice. Because when you have an epidemic situation, every people has COVID. If you work in the malaria context, people without test, when the patient arrive in the hospital with malaria, with the fever, they do diagnosis of malaria. So the COVID patient is a typical COVID patient. The symptoms are very typical. As Maurizio said, it's not difficult to manage. You have to do what you do usually with your ARDS patient. Many people are writing a lot about what type of medication for this patient. But if you have a good system, few think, good action, you can manage this. But if you don't use DPI, if you don't put in place surveillance system, you destroy your hospital.
Right.
This is what happens in Bergamo.
Right. So, are there other?
Now, think there is also in China's population about 50-30% of the personnel is ill. Is a lot. But the problem is that the other people work very hard, 7 days a day, as a week. So how much time can you continue this rhythm of work?
Right.
The people is not able to live with this situation of fragility, of precarity. You see every time die people, the people stay in hospital without parents. So the post-traumatic stress disorder in the health workers is very high. Mm. And so the people has not only clinical pathology, but also mental pathology.
Right, so right. Because of course,
When you work in a humanitarian crisis, the mental health of the staff is the main issue.
Right. I can't even imagine what you and your colleagues there have been going through, and that takes a real toll. So I want to ask you, Mirko, if there's anything else you, you know, we've talked about the importance of preventive techniques, trying to avoid spread, obviously, in every way we know how, with social isolation, effective, you know, cohorting of patients when they do get to the hospital, trying to keep anyone home who can be home. Testing needs to be emphasized. And we've at least in this country, according to Mike, we are going to start seeing more rapid testing, the likes of which they've had in South Korea for some time now. What about, Mike had mentioned to me when we were just talking offline earlier about what is, when you do have someone who is in the hospital, who's getting more hypoxic, escalating on oxygen, are you intubating them early to try to avoid a kind of emergency intubation so it can be more controlled?
So this was a question that in the first period of the epidemic situation, in the webinar, people try to respond, because some people say we have to intubate before, some people say we have to intubate after. In my opinion, it depends about your capacity to manage your patient in non-invasive ventilation. If you give non-invasive ventilation, but you don't control very, very well the nutrition status, probably your patient goes upstairs and you have to intubate. I see my hospital this situation. So the people think that if you give helmet CPAP or non-invasive ventilation is enough. No, you have to give nutrition, because I know is probably I say stupid thing, but this is what I see in my hospital. People speak about ECMO, and after that don't think the simple thing. I said to Maurizio, remember, pronation is good also during spontaneous ventilation. So I have no weight intubation to prone the patient. Why? It's the same, it's the same physiopathology. The lung, the posterior area of the lung when you are ill are less ventilated. So prone your patient. Try. When we do this in spontaneous ventilation, you do a test. I try a lot improvement in this.
Right. So treat this is you know, when you see ARDS, you want to think about your typical treatments. The nutrition thing is an important point as well. So when you intubate, again, these are not, you know, especially for the surgical ICU folks, these are not post-op patients who have had bowel surgery. These are patients with presumably an isolated respiratory illness. And so you can feed them right away, right? You want to intubate, if you're intubating them, you want to intubate them and put in a feeding, an oral gastric or a nasal gastric tube along with that ET tube so that you can start feeding right away. Is that right?
I don't understand really the question, Maurizio. Can you help me?
He's asking you if you think a patient should be fed early, as soon as you intubate them, or even before, place an nasogastric tube and feed them aggressively, because it sounds everybody's talking about feeding these patients seems to be an important
aspect. So, sorry, maybe I say stupid to think, but when the patient arrive in your hospital, probably is at home at least 1 week without it, because he's so hypoxic, then he has no possibility to eat. And it's very important as a measure to maintain a good status of nutrition. I think this is one of the reasons why the patient arrive in hospital with so severe pneumonia, because the symptomatology start 1 week before with a high fever. People describe 1, 2, 3 days, 4 days of fever at 40, and paracetamol doesn't work. And all this thing is very difficult at home, because you have no, you don't want it in this condition. For an elderly people, this is most important.
Right. So if you've got somebody who hasn't eaten for a week, they come in, again, this is the importance of feeding them early, because if you now wait another couple of weeks, you know, they're really gonna have been too long without nutrition. Maurizio, let me ask you if you...
I found several times patient quite young, 60, 50 of years. And when I was called to go in ambulance to take them, I found them die on the floor. And when I asked to the parents, but this patient had some comorbidities, the answer was not. What happens? I think the grade of hypoxia that the patient maintained for a long period may induce maybe heart attack, cardiac failure. When I go to take some patient, elderly patient, and they try saturation before to transfer the patient, I can catch 70.
Right. Right. So, and it's hard, right? Because you were saying that some patients who have mild disease, you know, you kind of want to keep at home on some oxygen. Obviously, you I guess if you do that, you give them some targets and a pulse oximeter and tell them if it falls,
yes,
you know, you need to come in if it falls to X, Y, or Z.
You have telemedicine. You can use it.
Right. Right.
But you have to improve the capacity of your area, peripheral area.
So right. Most our institutions have powerful home care services, at least in certain cities. I think we have to mobilize those early enough. That's something that I don't know how many are thinking about that. I'm proud of my institution because I think we've been very proactive and we're really planning way ahead. But I think that's something also people around should start considering. Use your home care system to go send your home nurses, home physical therapists, check on the saturation, bring them oxygen. These are things that can be done, and they can be done, mobilized relatively quickly.
Yeah. And Maurizio,
This is a proactive action to reduce the contamination.
Right. Mm.
You have to change your mind and think that The most important thing is to isolate the patient and reduce the contamination. So we have to think every action in this direction.
Right. And so, Mauricio, I was going to ask you if you, you know, you've obviously been in close contact with Mirko. You are aware of what's going on in Italy. And now you are one of the people helping at Penn to, get prepared for what, you know, we don't know, but what may turn out to be a similar situation. What lessons have you taken? What are you guys doing? What do you recommend that other folks who may be listening do to prepare?
Well, our dean has decided to stop all elective surgeries and clinic activities. And we are making escalation plans. We're still working on them, but so I can give you any details, but the plans include units that will be dedicated to these patients to avoid contamination of the hospital and on the other patients. We are working on protocols, so we are liberally using the inputs from Italy to create our own protocols. The Italians have created a very nice protocol that has been published by CRT, which is the Italian Society. I've been taking inputs from here and there. We've been integrating them. So we're going to create our own guidelines for airway management, mechanical ventilation, nutrition. I'm going to emphasize that even more now after talking to Mirko. So these are all things that people should be getting to do, start doing now. Like I told you before, talking to some of my colleagues around the country, the impression I'm getting is this is serious, but it's just a pneumonia. I will deal with it. No, it's not like this. Talk to your administrators, talk to everybody to try to create a crisis management state that has to be in place now, because I think we don't have much time. There are more things. I would say also, if I were to give a recommendation, would be think creatively of ways you can deliver intensive care, because again, that's what we're going to have to do anyway, in all kinds of situations, on the floors, in the operating rooms. Think about how you restructure your staffing and your call schedule and your model for staffing patients and ICUs and rooms. For example, think about using non-ICU providers to take care of this patient. I'm talking about anesthetists. We have legions of anesthesiologists and residents in anesthesia and nurse anesthetists. This is a relatively basic critical care, honestly. You don't need to do stuff that is too sophisticated. We can teach them and create teams. Like you do in Italy, pyramidal teams where you have intensive care physicians supervising other non-intensive care clinicians taking care of the patients. Think about ways you can deliver positive pressure in a safe way without ventilators. That's another problem we're going to have. The Italians use liberally helmet CPAP, which is not available in this country. So we need to figure out ways to do it. There's a lot of concern about using non-invasive ventilation. Right. Because it's been associated to spread of the virus during the SARS epidemic. Same concern applies to high flow nasal cannula, but although nobody really knows how much spreading there's going to be. The helmets are ideal because they allow you to deliver positive pressure in a simple way, just CPAP, because in a lot of patients that's all you need. Right. And put in an antimicrobial filter, you can actually isolate the patient from the rest of the room, which is fantastic.
Right.
Problem is that we don't have them. There are ways to go around this, but we're still on our side. We're still working on it.
Right. So just let me just say, in case folks aren't familiar. So when we talk about non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, we're talking about BiPAP, CPAP. Exactly. But the problem with those is that while when the patient breathes in, it's fine. When they breathe out, it just goes out into the room. And so what's thought is that positive pressure helps to create more viral particles leaving that mask and going out into the room and therefore increasing the potential for spread. The helmet that you mentioned, which we don't have, prevents that or can prevent it because it kind of seals the patient's head inside the helmet, gives them the positive pressure, but then the outflow doesn't have to go out into the room. High flow nasal cannula is what we're doing as a first step with a mask over the patient's mouth and nose. You know, maybe that's better. as a first step and then intubation straight from there without going to BiPAP or CPAP.
Exactly. One thing I've learned is that these patients tend to deteriorate very fast. So if I have to give a clinical pearl, is that patients will come in with mild opacities on chest X-ray and they will evolve very quickly. So don't wait to intubate these patients until they're crashing. So what I heard from some, and Mirko can confirm, what some practitioners do, they give a small trial of non-invasive positive pressure. And if the patient requires a high fraction of oxygen and they don't get better within a short time span, like half an hour or an hour, they will just go ahead and intubate. That's aggressive, but I think that's what we have to do. And we may end up with a lot more patients intubating in conditions that are different from where we intubate normally because of their evolution, but also because of the concern for getting infected, getting nurses and respiratory therapists and physicians infected.
Right. So, you know, big things we've talked about in terms of what people could do. So I think let's look at actually, before we summarize, let me ask you, healthcare workers. So obviously a lot of anxiety in healthcare workers who know that they're going to be taking care of more and more, probably already are, certainly are going to be taking care of more and more of these patients. What advice should we be recommending? And this is obviously changing rapidly and will probably be, whatever we say now, maybe out of date tomorrow. But, you know, should people, let's talk about anesthesiologists. You're going to see your patient in pre-op. Should we just be wearing masks and eye protection now for everybody? What should we be recommending to healthcare workers in general? Obviously, taking care of someone with known COVID is different than taking care of someone who we don't know if they have it or not, or don't suspect. Known COVID patients obviously should be isolated. We should be doing, you know, full protective equipment, probably a PAPR. If not an N95, maybe probably a PAPR is better, is what we think. But what about patients who may not have it, but we're not sure?
This is a good question because we did not do anything about your question, and this was the most problem. Because we found a lot of patients infected after surgery.
Right.
So also for this question, is important to do proactive. So I think it's important to start a cluster survey on patient, on personnel, to find one case. If you find one case, maybe it's important to start a DPI system for COVID infection area. One case is enough. Don't wait for 10 cases, 20 cases. One case is enough.
Right. And Maurizio, what are you guys doing around that? What are you telling people to do?
So we're in the process of defining what the high-risk intubation is, and that's a little controversial. Of course, patients who are coming from outside with fever and respiratory symptoms, we will also use all the precautions. The question is, what do you do when somebody goes in respiratory failure on the floor who has been there for other reasons? I think for now we can continue to screen patients for respiratory symptoms. So I would say anybody who's coming from outside and with a suspected pneumonia should be assumed to be COVID no matter what the testing status is. For a while, I think it's going to be fine, but I think it may change because once everybody, you know, once the rate of infection becomes so high, you know, you may assume that your colon from yesterday may have it. So we may end up doing everybody like that, although it doesn't sound terribly practical. It's a working process. For the actual intubation itself, there are articulated protocols for how you wear and how you take off your protective equipment. Yeah. We are prescribing N95 with a gown and with gloves, double gloving actually, right. And a face shield. I would recommend a face shield, not just goggles. I suspect a lot of people will feel even more comfortable using PAPRs for oral intubation.
Right. That's what we're doing.
Yeah, if you and I definitely need to use a PAPR because we have facial hair. I would say use a PAPR, and if it's available, use it for oral intubations. That would be safe. Learn how to place it. And actually, it's a nice system. A system we're adopting is the body system. So one person gets dressed and undressed, and one person watches that person.
Right.
That's another thing where telemedicine comes handy, because we're going to use telemedicine to monitor this process. And that's a nice thing, honestly. Let me see if I'm missing anything. There's a broad definition of what an aerosolizing procedure is. We are considering the high-risk procedures, intubations, but also bronchoscopies. Mm-hmm. We are recommending not to do bronchoscopy unless you strictly have to. Try to limit awake bronchoscopies, which is especially, they're probably the worst ones. And other things, but that we can imagine. But essentially, treat most of your intubation as high risk, because the chances of your patient having it are becoming higher and higher every day.
Yeah, and yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, when I'm personally, I'm thinking, all right, I'm going to, you know, if I'm in the operating room for a given day, I'm going to see my patient in pre-op. I'm probably going to wear a mask and a face shield. Just, you know, that's just going to be my approach, right? I mean, it's, I think we need to be assuming, like you said, and like Mirko said, you got to assume that some people have it. Could be your colleagues, could be the patients. And I think not even for our own protection, but so that we don't end up spreading it. That seems like, why not? You're going to wear a mask and eye protection in the operating room anyway. Keep it on when you go to the preoperative area. I think that makes sense. What do you think?
I think
makes sense. Is a great changement, because you know when you walk, you see another people, and you think maybe it could be him that give me the virus. It's not good to live in this situation, but this is the reality now.
Right.
So now the. Our city are desert. When you walk, you stay 2 meters.
Right.
Nobody give the hands. I live at home. It's 2 weeks that I sleep alone without my wife.
Right.
I can stay with my child. This is the situation, no? Because now the epidemic is without control.
Right.
And if you don't start before to do a paranoid, as Maurizio said, your life will be destroyed, and you don't know when you can restart your normal life. This is the situation of the low-income country. It's the same.
Right. Right. Now, let me just ask you too, and I know we don't know much about this, but you know, there's some talk about thinking about you know, treatments and vaccines. So, you know, I think this is very early on, but convalescent serum is something that I've heard is being thought about. Can you take the, you know, serum of people who have had the virus and recovered, and you know, get antibodies either for treatment or for prevention? You know, maybe a small inoculate dose in healthcare workers, for example, to maybe be preventative. And then, of course, vaccines. But is anything, are you either of you aware of any of this that's actually being done or anywhere near being put into place?
So now there is a protocol in place implemented by infectivology, and we give the protocol is composed by two antiretroviral used for HIV to stop the protease action, and by chloroquine. And in the last week is what put in place ritonavir, the inhibitor of interleukin-6. that was used in cytokine release syndrome after chemotherapy. It mm-hmm. seems to reduce the inflammatory response. So I'm not very excited about that. For okay. for this, because if you don't use well the helmet, if you don't give nutrition, you do inhibitor of the interleukin 6. For me, it is not, there is no sense. Before you do the good action to treat your respiratory failure, and after that you think the medication. Take present that there is a big ethical issue in catastrophic situation, because the consensus is an issue, the ethical committee is an issue, because you have no time. And I discuss a lot with some people of the hospital, because now the consensus process for ritonavir is implemented in this way. Dyspnoic people stay in the room without parents, and the doctor arrive and ask to dyspnoic people to give consensus for ritonavir. So what do you think? Is a consensus this, or is another thing?
Right. For right. Me, so you're saying that consent is an issue, especially for people who may be sick enough to be, you know, not fully with it, or certainly for kids.
If I'm going to die, probably I give consent for everything.
Right. Right.
But this is a big issue in a catastrophic humanitarian situation. There is a lot of paper about that.
Right. Right.
So be prepared also for this, because there is a lot of space of research, but you have to think about your ethical method to put in process this research strategy.
Right.
I completely agree with Mirko. That's not a suggestion to say get your ethical committee to start writing a document now, because you may end up using it.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, things, let me try to kind of summarize some of the stuff we've talked about that people can keep in mind. I mean, the biggest one, and I think this is can't be hammered home enough, is the prevention. We need people to be, as now is happening, right? Schools are closing here. People are being asked to stay home. I think one of the big challenges in this country, in the United States, is that, Maurizio.
They're not staying at home. I just got a text message by one of my colleagues that are bar hopping, you know, in Central City.
Right. Well, exactly. Okay. So I was going to say, one of the big challenges in this country is that people don't like to be told what to do, right? And that voluntary asking people to stay home, people like to go to their restaurants and their bars. And, you know, I think that's the challenge we're seeing now, is that, you know, it does take self-sacrifice. You have to stay home. And there's been some interesting articles in the media saying, hey, look, if you're not worried about getting it yourself, that's not the only issue, right? It's that you're going to infect other people, especially older people, right? One example a lot of us are dealing with is having to think about whether the grandparents come take care of the kids, which maybe for a lot of people, the healthcare, these childcare they normally rely on. And we've had to say no, right? We don't want our grandparents coming in to take care of the kids, because that puts them at risk, and they're in that high risk category.
I don't want to sound too harsh, but there are a lot of young people who are dying, and the messages people are getting still is, this is a bad influenza, don't worry, it will affect only old and sick people. So if you're 25, you don't care. But there are actually, you know, a fair amount of 20-year-old or even 18-year-old, I believe, also in Italy, who are on a ventilator in the ICU.
Right.
They should emphasize that. Sometimes I think maybe we should just to, you know, place the picture of these dead people on the newspaper. So this is what who died yesterday, and you see that, and you get scared. Honestly, you have to terrorize people. And
yeah, no, absolutely. So prevention is huge. In the hospital, cohorting patients, intubating early, intubating safely, having personal protective equipment, having protocols in place, like you said, and we have similar ones of double or triple gloving, double or, you know, gowning or double gowning, using N95s or PAPRs, making sure that, you know, you are having someone watch you take that off so you don't contaminate, being careful, not just with confirmed cases, but anyone who's in any at any risk, maybe with everyone, whether they're, you know, officially a high risk patient or not, to be aware that this could be spreading, thinking about intubating early, thinking about early nutrition, thinking about, you know, if we do end up with a lot of cases, the way what's happened in Italy, if we are overwhelmed in our capacity in hospitals, thinking about who can stay home. Mike mentioned to me earlier offline that you guys in Penn are even not put this in place, but thinking about if you had to, could you use one ventilator for two patients with kind of similar body mass and similar lung compliance? So you Y off your tubing and you provide, you know, two people on one
ventilator.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, again, if we get to the point of being overwhelmed in our system, we're going to have to think creatively. But really, I think the message for everybody is has got to be, you know, pass on the bar, pass on the restaurant, pass on the trip, you know, stay away from other people to the extent you can. And if you have to be at work because you're a healthcare provider, take care of yourself, take care of your colleagues. And for, you know, higher level hospital administrations, whether it's at a big academic center or whether it's at a community hospital, you know, don't wait, right? We this is here and it's probably going to get worse. And we don't want to be in a situation like Mirko has described where we're having to, you know, have protocols that tells us who gets to have a chance at a ventilator and who has to die. We want to prevent us from getting there. So am I leaving anything out? Are those the main take home messages we want people to have?
I think so. What do you think, Mirko?
I think so. Probably if we give another name to COVID, the COVID is the first name and the second name is Ebola. Think as this virus is Ebola. If you think that, probably you do correct action. So search for the treatment of Ebola in Africa and try to learn something about it.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. People are much more scared of Ebola, not for some reason, not of this, but need to think of it that way. That's a great point. Well, look, I want to thank you both so much. Mirko, especially you are, I can't imagine what you're going through. You're on the front line in a way that we aren't. And thank you for everything you're doing to care for people there, to get this word out, to try to give us fair warning so we can learn from what you've gone through. I'm sorry that you're going through it, but I thank you for everything you're doing.
So thank you for your attention. I hope to can give you some useful information. We have to remember that one of the duty of our work is advocacy, and that the clinical condition of our patient are always expression of social problems. So we have to maintain this direction in our mind, I think. So absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Maurizio, thank you for everything you're doing
here. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you.
We'll be, obviously, I'm sure our institutions will be collaborating and thinking through this, and we all need to be learning from those like Mirko who have really have been ahead on this and have been through what we may be going through, and hopefully we can prevent that from happening.
Thank you. Thank you, Jared. I appreciate
thank you.
Good
thank
night.
You.
Ciao, Mirko.
All right. Well, that was really powerful. I think that I learned a ton and also just, you know, gained some perspective on how serious this thing really is. I really hope that the rest of you did too. Please share this so people can learn. Please have these discussions with your own communities about self quarantining, about social isolation. Please have these discussions if you're healthcare providers, with your leadership, with your hospital systems, about what we can all do to keep each other safe and, of course, keep our patients safe and prevent the kind of spread that they've seen there in Italy. Please feel free to go to the website, acrac.com, leave a comment, let us know what you thought, let us know what you're learning when your own experience with this virus. If you think these messages are important, please spread the word. You can tweet this out on Twitter. You can follow us. We're at Jay Walbaugh and at ACRAC Podcast. You can join the Facebook group. Spread the word. People can learn from what you have to say and from all of this. If you go to the to iTunes and leave a comment and a rating, it'll help others find the show. They can access this information as well. Of course, you can go to patreon.com to make a to become a patron, make donations, but we're not going to go into a lot of detail on that right now. I want people to focus on the message. And just a usual huge thank you to Kimmy Akash Cooley, our intern, to Dr. Brian Park and April Liu for the work they do on the outlines. And of course, our original ACRAG music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo, and his website is studymusicproject.com. So please do what you can to get the word out and keep everybody, yourself, and everybody around you safe. Thank you so much for listening. For the ACRAG podcast and Doctors Scott, Sereda, and Nakoti, I'm Jed Walpaw. Remember, what you're doing out there every day, now more than ever, is incredibly important and very, very valued. Thank you. Stay safe and stay healthy.